This is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. Mass culture, conformism, alienation, totalitarianism, Marxism, and modernism. These and so many other phenomena and lines of inquiry occupied the attention of the Frankfurt School, a formidable grouping of German radical thinkers who left their home country following Adolf Hitler's rise to power. They arrived in New York City, and what they did and the connections they made with American thinkers and institutions is the subject of a new book by Thomas Wheatland. It's called The Frankfurt School in Exile. What was mass culture doing to the independence and imagination of working people? How did the Frankfurt School thinkers interact with American leftists like Irving Howe, Dwight MacDonald, and Sidney Hook? And was Herbert Marcuse, in fact, a guru of the new left? Did the student radicals of the 60s really hang on to his every word? Thomas Wheatland is an assistant professor of German history at Assumption College in Worcester, Massachusetts. I began by asking Tom for a nutshell description of the Frankfurt School, more formally known as the Institute for Social Research.
You'd have to compare it in modern day terms to something along the lines of a think tank. It was an academic institute that was affiliated with the University of Frankfurt with a private subsidy from the Weil family. And it was populated by an entirely interdisciplinary research team. The cast of characters changed over time, which meant that the specialties being emphasized by the researchers changed over time. But during the time frame that I write about the institute and during the time in which it achieved its notoriety and that it's probably best remembered for, it really truly was a multidisciplinary affair. So the purpose was to develop a comprehensive theory of contemporary society. And to accomplish that, the idea was to combine social science, Wissenschaft, with philosophy. So you'd have sociology being informed by philosophy, which today we'd refer to that mix as social theory. But at the time, the idea was that the theory production would then drive new directions in the sociology, and the sociology at the same time would constantly fuel and help to alter the theory production. So in terms of staff, the director of the institute was a philosopher, Max Horkheimer. There were also several economists on the staff, but Horkheimer's second in command was an economist by the name of Friedrich Pollack, who really functioned as a kind of administrator of the institute. There was another full-time philosopher on the staff who didn't get brought in until the mid-30s. That was Herbert Marcuse. There was a psychologist, Eric Fromm, a musicologist who also dabbled in sociology as well as philosophy, a very versatile scholar, Theodor Wiesengrund Adorno. And then you had literary scholars like Walter Benjamin and Leo Löwenthal. They had a lot of different disciplines represented, but that was a reflection of the kind of sociological and theoretical task that they'd set for themselves.
Many very influential people were part of this Frankfurt School. Now, your book focuses on the institutional relationships formed and fostered by the Frankfurt School scholars here in the U.S. Why that focus?
Well, a lot has been, obviously a lot has been written about this group of people. The exile years have been written about, but they've been written about in a way in which they tend to focus primarily on the impact that exile had on the evolution and changes that the theoretical work and sociological work that the Institute produced, the impact that it had on that. And initially, much of that story was an oral history. It was told by members of the Institute that were still alive. Martin Jay famously recorded and collected this history and then was able to report it faithfully and very accessibly in his book, The Dialectical Imagination. Years later, there was another sort of monumental history written about the Institute by a German, Rolf Wiggershaus. But as a German and as someone who is focusing so much on the inner workings of the Institute, he hadn't looked at it in the context of the exile experience in America. So while he reflects on the impact that exile has on the Institute, what he doesn't do, and that's what I've tried to do, is to look at this as an institution navigating within this foreign environment and finding a path among formal academic institutions and also public intellectual institutions such as magazines and people maybe less enmeshed within the professional confines of the university. So it was a significant gap that appeared to me as I was conceptualizing this project. And I think what I've attempted to do is to try and fill that gap.
According to your book, members of the Frankfurt School first began settling in this country in 1934. When they first arrived, and in the few years thereafter, was it their inclination to engage with American intellectual communities or to isolate themselves from those communities?
In terms of the academic intellectual communities, there were clear expectations that there was a certain amount of collaboration that had to take place, and there were natural places where that could happen. I mean, Eric Fromm was largely one of the main public faces of the Institute, but that was to largely fulfill commitments and obligations that they felt that they had to Columbia University and to faculty at Columbia. As far as the broader American picture, the Institute was very guarded and did not seek out these kinds of relationships. I think having had the experiences that they had just emerged from in Europe, being driven out of Germany in 1933 with the rise of the Nazis, they were very careful and deliberative about what they wanted to share with people. And these were very political times, and so they could be extremely withdrawn at times, which from the standpoint of the broader intellectual community, especially in New York, which is where they initially were, that meant some missed opportunities.
Now, the thinkers of the Frankfurt School were engaged with the Marxian intellectual project, and part of what made them reluctant to talk politics when they first got to the U.S. was because of the radical nature of what they were thinking and saying. Mm. How would you characterize the Frankfurt School's attitude or approach toward Marxian ideas?
One really important thing to understand about them is that they were all unaffiliated Marxists, unlike a lot of other comparable figures from Europe during this time period or from the United States during this time period. They weren't members of the Social Democratic Party. They weren't members of the Communist Party. They weren't syndicalists. They were unaffiliated, unallied. I mean, they certainly were heavily influenced by Marx, and they were profoundly influenced by the revolutions that had occurred in Germany in 1918 and 1919. But in terms of, you know, they were critical of the Soviet Union. That was something that was understood and assumed and came up a lot in conversations with one another, but that's not something that they would ever share with anybody else in the context of this country. I think the other thing that made them maybe unusual as Marxists during this time period is that they were very critical of Marx. I mean, there's a famous interview, I don't know how famous it is, but it's that Brian McGee did. He used to have a television show from the UK on philosophy, and he had Marcuse on as a guest, and he asked Marcuse this whole long series of questions about Marx. And, you know, in general, many of the judgments were quite critical and biting. And then McGee sort of finished up this line of questioning by saying, So why is it that you're a Marxist? You've just articulated some of the most devastating critiques of Marx that I've ever heard in my life. How can you still call yourself that? So So that's, you know, compared to a lot of other people, especially in this country that they encountered in New York, who considered themselves Trotskyists, or maybe that wasn't even good enough. They were Shachtmanites, you know. So it's highly factionalized, but also, you know, people taking very identifiable political and cultural positions These were people that didn't want to get into that. And I think the fact that they did things like remain silent about the Soviet Union created tremendous suspicion among Americans who might have found them quite stimulating. But the fact that an issue like that, that these people from the Institute wouldn't talk about that, that seemed at the very best that they were fellow travelers, at the very worst that they were, you know, Asian provocateurs or something like that. Mm-hmm. So you know, I don't think it was intended to have these detrimental effects. It certainly wasn't. It was intended to avoid those. But I think, you know, sometimes when one is silent about certain topics, that creates a different type of problems.
There's such a rich discussion in this book, and we decided to focus on two sections of the book. One, the interactions that the Frankfurt School, or the lack thereof, that the school had with a group called the New York Intellectuals, and also, and we'll get to this later, Herbert Marcuse's relationship to the New Left. He's been portrayed in the mainstream media, and he was, as a guru, as one of the principal gurus of the New Left in the 1960s, and you explore that claim and you contest that claim in this book. But let's start with the New York Intellectuals. They coalesced in New York City and specifically Greenwich Village. Tell us about this group and who belonged to it.
They're a hard group to define. I focused on four magazines in particular that had stables of writers that they consistently asked to write pieces for them. So Partisan Review is probably the most famous of these journals. There's also Commentary that was later published by the American Jewish Committee, Politics, which was founded by Dwight MacDonald, and Dissent, which was founded and managed for many years by Irving Howe and by Louis Kozer. These were all leftists of one stripe or another. Many of them, I mean, Partisan Review started out as an organ of the Communist Party, but as time went on, the shackles that the Communist Party put on them, the lack of freedom that it gave them, created tremendous tension. And then I think also it was, these were, as the term that we use to describe them, their label suggests, they were intellectuals. And much of the Communist Party at that time was not interested in quite the kind of highbrow, overt intellectualism that these writers and journals tended to promote. They also, in addition to being leftists who increasingly became intensely anti-Stalinist, I mean, they came to embody a kind of anti-Stalinist left, but way before McCarthyism ever took shape, but it was still left. They also were some of the most passionate supporters of modernism in the arts. So Clement Greenberg came out of this milieu as a champion of abstract expressionism. And you also had some of the first and most articulate proponents of European avant-garde literature.
And when you say modernist, there was a whole, of course, modernist movement and modernist project. Is it easiest for listeners just to think of it in terms of avant-garde art and aesthetics?
Yeah, I would say to some degree, they felt, and this is where I think many of them became interested in similar themes as what the Frankfurt School was grappling with. They had a sense that there was a natural relationship between modernism's ability to express and explore in very innovative ways consciousness, human consciousness. And they felt that these very advanced forms of art also had, I mean, this was also modernism as they understood it was highly cosmopolitan. It was internationalist. And that's also the way that they saw Marxism. So there is a way in which they believed that there was a natural affinity between their politics and their cultural preferences, but how one sorted that out, that became a very problematic and complicated task for them to articulate. And that is ultimately, I think, where the Frankfurt School wound up becoming quite influential for many of them.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in some detail as the hour goes along. So you have members of the Frankfurt School arriving in New York City in the mid-1930s. Which people and what kinds of people served as initial bridges between the Frankfurt School, the Horkheimer Circle, and New York's intellectual communities?
It was largely editors and translators. One of the biggest obstacles that members of the Frankfurt School had was the ability to communicate this very complex writing style that they had adopted, to communicate that to English audiences. They had translators who really functioned as full-blown editors who were assisting them with this. And they really are a pretty extraordinary group of people. Moses Finkelstein, who most people don't know by that name, most people know him by the name that he adopted later in life. That's M.I. Finley. He was a famous classicist at Oxbridge in England. He was one of the first and earliest translators and editors for these people. He was a classical historian, kind of pioneered the social history of the classical world and social history of ideas in the classical world. And he was also an instructor at City College in New York City. So as a teacher at City College, he had people in his class like Daniel Bell, like Irving Howe, like Nathan Glaser. And that's one of the ways that word of the Frankfurt School started to circulate among the world of the New York intellectuals. In addition to M.I. Finley, there was also Benjamin Nelson, who went on to become another noted social historian and social scientist. He was a translator and an editor for the Institute, and similarly also taught at City College. So it was largely through people like this that people connected with these little magazines started to become aware of them. And because of eventually, as all these people graduated from college and began trying to eke out these bohemian lives as freelance writers, many of this younger generation of New York intellectuals wound up actually doing editorial work and translation work for the Institute during the 1940s. So Daniel Bell was also a translator and editor for the Institute on some significant projects as well. Nathan Glaser was also a research assistant of Max Horkheimer during the mid-1940s. And Irving Howe was a ghost editor of Prophets of Deceit, which was a book written by Leo Löwenthal.
Thomas Wheatland joins us on Against the Grain. He teaches German history at Assumption College, and he is author of the book The Frankfurt School in Exile. And by in exile, he means the years, or many of the years, that the Frankfurt School scholars spent in the U.S. and in New York City specifically, although, of course, Herbert Marcuse, for example, eventually moved to San Diego. And I want to bring his name up and his activities in relation to the New Left later this hour. One way we can talk about the impact of Frankfurt School ideas on the New York intellectuals is to discuss what the Frankfurt School came to think about mass culture and authoritarianism and the links between mass culture and art and authoritarianism, totalitarianism, fascism. What links did they begin to make? And then later on, I guess we can talk about how those ideas were received in New York.
Mm-hmm. Well, initially, they had been doing social scientific work on the study of authority. They'd been studying it in relation to families. So authoritarianism was something that they'd been studying for a long time. And this is one of the reasons why among emigre groups, they weren't exactly surprised by the coming of Nazism to Germany, which is part of the reason they got out as early as they did. So they'd been interested in authoritarianism for quite a long time. They'd also been interested in aesthetics for a long time. Their approach to art, whether it be literature or music, was to take a sociological approach to it. So to look at a particular piece of art. So take, for example, Adorno writing about Schönberg, the atonal musical composer from Vienna. There's a way in which Adorno would look at Schönberg in relation to society at that moment in time and would also then theorize about the reception that Schönberg was having. And he would speculate and theorize about Schönberg's overall significance to music. That starts to change as the Institute does more and more work on authority. I think that as they come to see that the working class for example, which, you know, as many Marxists, they'd had some hope in the working class progressively changing society as they conducted these studies on both the German working class and then authoritarianism within families. They came to realize that these hopes were unjustified and that there was a kind of political conformity, a kind of deference to authority itself that seemed to be endemic within the working class and within other strata of German and American society. And that then also began to affect many of the ways that they started thinking about art. So just as they saw increasing amounts of conformity in the political and social and cultural behavior of ordinary people, they also began to focus and uncover more and more cultural conformity in the realm of aesthetic production. So really the rise of mass culture, of mass art, became a preoccupation and a fascination of theirs. Now, unlike a lot of other people who wrote about mass art, and particularly a lot of Americans who wrote about mass art, a lot of people like to look at it as a kind of big business conspiracy. This was something that Hollywood, for example, was foisting on these innocent audiences, and there was this insidious brainwashing that was going on. But the Frankfurt School's analysis of mass culture was quite a bit more nuanced than that. They wanted to really dissect what a mass culture product was, so functionally what it looked like, and then what relationship did it have to the audience? And then to look at the larger social trends as to why there was more of this being produced and less, you know, what people might have referred to as autonomous art or authentic art. And that ultimately is something quite different from what a lot of other critics of mass culture were doing either in this country or in other parts of Europe during the time.
And he is Thomas Wheatland, and I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain. Thomas is an assistant professor of German history at Assumption College in Worcester, Massachusetts, and author of the book The Frankfurt School in Exile. And we're going to take a short music break and be back to speak more with Thomas Wheatland. Please stay with us.